balancing wisdom with confidence and joy. Although this talk is not specifically about contemplating impermanence, death, and dying, I thought to include it as it does contain some information which might be helpful for gaining a broader sense of practice. I hope something here is useful to you. So I don't know what I'm going to talk about yet. So I might need some help. I guess everybody here has some interest in Dharma practice. So I'm going to ask you, any ideas, anything, what would you be interested to hear? What might be helpful in your life, in this path of cultivating generosity and maintaining ethical precepts, developing the mind? Is there anything that you are interested to hear about? Throw it out there. Is that it? Yep. Gaya vipassana. Cittanupassana.
This first question is, can you say something about Gaya Nusati and Citta Nusati, which is mindfulness of the body and mindfulness of mind objects or the mind?
Gaya Nupassana is, so we're talking about the four foundations of mindfulness, developing insight into the nature of the body. When talking about Vipassana, we're trying to see the three characteristics of phenomena, true characteristics, which is anicca, dukkha and anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactory and not self. So any insight will be into those three qualities, one of those three qualities. To try to see the impermanence, not self nature of mind states is difficult because they're kind of deluding, as many of us have a lot of experience. If we focus on developing a lot of body-based mindfulness, my teacher teaches that at a certain point, that mindfulness which is generated in the body will simply see mind states according to those characteristics. So you develop the awareness of the breathing, the awareness of what you're doing with the body, and also contemplating impermanence of feelings in the body, that kind of thing. That will give you the foundation to be able to see mind states as mind states. And dhammas that arise in the mind as dhammas that arise in the mind and see them arise and cease. How do you practice? How do you try to practice Gaya Nupassana? Right. I think it is the foundation, at least how I understand it. But if you can, obviously, if you can notice the sensation on the not self of mind states, that's good. I mean, it may just be your character that you can do that, but even so, generating good, clear body-based mindfulness is going to help that. But in terms of investigation, I think the trick is, or the key is, to notice is your mind becoming peaceful when you do that. So if when cultivating mind states and noticing they're not self or impermanence, if your mind is becoming peaceful, well then I would say it's correct practice and you can continue with it. But if it's just, okay, another mind state, and then another mind state, and you have to keep noticing, and the mind isn't slowing and isn't stilling, and that sense of clarity and space isn't becoming more enhanced, then it may not be so strong, that practice. Only you can know that. But even just mindfulness of breathing is developing that body awareness. So I try to make that the foundation anyway, that's what I do. And just really try to just be aware of the feelings of the breath, and then you can contemplate mind states after doing that for a period of time. how it seems to work for me. Walking meditation is also a very good thing to do. Underestimated practice. It does develop a very good body-based awareness, which is a little more resilient than the peacefulness that comes from sitting. So it seems a little tedious and boring and unsophisticated at first glance. And I suppose doing it at home might also seem a bit abstract. But the fact is, I mean, my experience of many people is that kind of clarity that you get after a half an hour of walking, the kind of mindfulness you can bring to other phenomena with your eyes open in the world, is more resilient than the kind of peacefulness that you get in the sitting. And a lot of people have that experience of having a fairly peaceful sit and getting up and moving around and answering a few emails or something, and it's kind of gone. So I think walking meditation is a very good foundation. Certainly the monks and nuns in Thailand and Burma alternate those practices, understanding that they support each other. Do a lot of walking meditation, generate good, sharp, body-based mindfulness so that when you sit, you'll notice these arising and ceasing of feelings and mind states with more clarity, more strength to the mindfulness. So that might help, just really feeling the feelings at the bottom of the feet, making an effort to do that, and sharpen the mindfulness, generate the mindfulness before sitting. Very helpful. Do you have a space where you can do walking at home, or? Limited, yeah. Yeah, and kind of slow, going slow is okay as well. And when you go slow, you can note the lifting, the moving and the placing, lifting, moving, placing, really slow things down. Good thing to do. Any other questions? Ajahn Anan is a disciple of Ajahn Chah. He's in southeast Thailand, in Rayong. Have you heard of him? Yeah. Yeah. Right.
This second question is, do you think that you need to have jhana, which is a very profound level of collectedness, in order to attain sotapanna, the first level of enlightenment?
So I'd rather not talk about my opinions, I'll talk about what my teacher has said. I'll talk about what Ajahn Chah said, as far as I understand. You need some samadhi and some collectedness. That gives the mind some integrity. The samadhi supports the sati. But Ajahn Chah also teaches that it's a consistency of mindfulness with clear comprehension that gives rise to samadhi. So it's a consistency of mindfulness with clear comprehension. The clear comprehension part is the part that sees with wisdom. Ajahn Anan is always talking about sati and panya. Consistency of that, mindfulness and wisdom, so that's like the thing that sees a thought as a thought. It's not kind of making a self out of everything. This is tricky, but that's actually what clear comprehension means. It means seeing a thought as a thought, not once we really are the personality and, you know, my feeling and what they think and what I think, that's not really clear comprehension anymore. When you really can see the feeling as the feeling, the thought as the thought, come back to the breath or come back to the Bodhicarma they teach in Thai, Buddho, whatever it is that you're trying to maintain as a mind, as a gamatana, you're doing that consistently is what gives rise to samadhi. And the samadhi is what will enable the insight to have power behind it. So you'll cut through delusion. But not necessary to the point of jhana. It's basically understood that if you can cultivate absorption, it's good, because the power of the mind after that point will develop insight much more quickly. But my teachers have taught that, you know, Kanika Samadhi and Upajara Samadhi is enough, but you have to be more energetic. You have to be very consistent. And Ajahn Anan teaches that if you kind of developing a certain amount of energy and you're doing it and then you kind of relax a bit and then you do it again and it's not going to work yet. But it is encouraging to know that you can develop very profound insight without jhana. So certainly Ajahn Anan has said that. He uses these kind of hand movements, which I find quite helpful. He's talking about, you've got Upajara Samadhi, which is almost jhana, where the five hindrances are very, very subtle. And so he said, he's talking about Sotapatti Magga, entering, getting the path to Sotapanna. He says it's like this. It's like, you've got to be there, then, and then it's like, but he says that kind of, if that speaks to you, that sense of making the mind as peaceful as you can, as peaceful as you can, as peaceful as you can, investigating, in kind of a liberating, a profound insight. But it is encouraging to know that. And I know Ajahn Sumedho doesn't talk about samadhi very much, but I also know he has it. It's the consistency of whatever meditation object you're using. If you can use it consistently, samadhi will be there. So I think Ajahn Sumedho doesn't like to talk about it so much, because if we get willful about it and it's coming from the self and you want samadhi, that's actually an obstruction. So it's very difficult to get when you come from that space. So he's always talking about wisdom, 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 because that's what most Westerners can understand. But, you know, he knows what his meditation objects are and he's very consistent about using them, and he does have samadhi. So I know that from personal conversations with him. But yeah. So I think we all need to learn which meditation methods work for us, which ones make the mind significantly peaceful. So that's another thing Ajahn Anand talks about, is knowing what's right for your character, but only you can know that. And it's not that difficult to know. Basically, it's the meditation object that you like, the meditation object that gives rise to some feelings of rapture. That's the one that's appropriate for your character. And whatever it is that can give you that peacefulness, do that one a lot. And then that will be the foundation for your contemplations, your investigations. Myself, I like metta bhavana a lot. And anti-anusati is recollecting the Buddha, and even deva-anusati, things like that, I find very uplifting. Brighten the mind and then contemplate impermanence, not self, that kind of thing. Just thought I'd ask as an interesting question. How many people believe in Nibbana? Kind of I'm realizing about English people, you can't just take it for granted that they'll actually ask you a question. You have to ask them questions. I lived in California for a little bit of time, and also in Australia. You ask anyone, got any questions, and half the room puts their hands up. But in England, there's this awkward pause, and somebody at the back of the room slowly. But anyway, it's quite nice. Somebody explained to me that the English are modest, and that's a beautiful quality. It's nice to be modest. But I'm interested to know how many people believe in Nibbana. Who thinks Nibbana exists? I want to see your hands raised in the air. You don't have to. I'm just interested to know who does. Okay. How many people aren't sure? Not sure if Nibbana exists. Most people. Over this side. You believe in Nibbana? You think it exists? Yeah. And you? Not sure. What is Nibbana? I'm asking you a question. What do you think Nibbana is? Beyond the conditioned, yeah. Ajahn Chah had a nice thing to say about Nibbana. Ajahn Chah said, Nibbana is the reality of the cessation of greed, hatred, and delusion. And I think that he was speaking from that reality, which is very nice. So we have a tendency, some of us, it's good to, Ajahn Pasana Ajahn Amaro just wrote this book called The Island. We don't have many copies yet, but it's excerpts from the suttas where the Buddha actually talks about Nibbana. A lot of people have a belief that the Buddha didn't talk about Nibbana very much, that he talked about the path to it. He did talk about that more, but actually if you put all the times that he did mention Nibbana together in a book, the book is this fat. So Ajahn Pasana Ajahn Amaro found many very nice quotes about it. And so the Buddha did talk about it as being, you know, something that exists, or something that is to be realized. So it's not nihilism, and it's not eternalism. So this is tricky to understand. If it's not nihilism and it's not eternalism, what is it? And but many of us think, if I can go beyond self-view and develop insight, then I won't suffer anymore. And but there isn't much joy necessarily in that. One of the reasons I wanted to mention this. And I think it's very helpful in practice to be optimistic and joyful about the goal. It's like something to look forward to, not from a position of craving, but from a position of optimism, confidence, faith. So that all the practice that we do, it actually has a goal. There is a reason for it. It'll have an outcome. And that outcome is going to be very pleasant. So when talking about Nibbana, the Buddha said that it was the supreme bliss. But that's not a statement about something nihilistic, is it? The supreme bliss, unshakable peace, was something he said about Nibbana. So those are very nice contemplations. Ajahn Chah, coming back to Ajahn Chah, the reality of the cessation of greed, hatred and delusion. So it's just nice to consider that we develop some concentration, we develop some insight, we weaken our delusion, insight gets deeper, slowly chipping away at greed, weakening hatred by keeping precepts, being generous, cultivating the mind. It is nice to recollect that the result of that is going to be unshakable peace. The result of that is going to be the highest bliss, supreme bliss. It's a nice thing to bring to mind. I think having spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia and noticing the quality of faith that Southeast Asians have, they're very optimistic and very enthusiastic and very joyful about their religion. And Westerners, we can tend to be, oh, I've got to do something about greed, hatred and delusion. And it's a bit grim sometimes. So it's nice to, at times, think about the result, why we do all this practice. Another thing that it's nice is there's other occasions in the suttas where the Buddha talks about where Nibbana is to be realized. And he said that it's to be realized within this fathom-long body. So somewhere between the top of your head and your toes, Nibbana is to be realized. Now this is very interesting contemplation. I find it interesting anyway. In as much as what that is inferring or alluding to is that right now in your body and mind, there's the potential for unshakable peace and supreme bliss. So that's an interesting thing just to bring to mind. So why don't we experience that? Why aren't I experiencing supreme bliss? Or why aren't I experiencing unshakable peace? We are, as we understand, affected by greed, aversion and delusion upon a foundation of ignorance. But it's just nice to recollect one's potential. And I think it's okay to be very confident about this. In fact, I think it's very helpful to really digest the fact that you have the potential to realize unshakable peace and supreme bliss. Ordinary you. Because I think a lot of the time where, you know, we believe our diminished and deluded experience so completely that we're not very confident about our abilities, and that lack of confidence affects our capacity to put forth effort. So it's like, well, just remember, as a human being with a body and a mind, there is greed, hatred and ignorance, but those things can be weakened and then eradicated, uprooted, and the result is the reality of the cessation of greed, hatred and delusion. So that's something to feel happy about, enthusiastic about. That recollection can give us some energy. So, oh, that's interesting. Being interested in one's potential is very helpful. It can generate a lot of energy. So, oh, I should meditate. You know, it's a different attitude to the, oh, yeah, I've got to meditate. Aspiring for a little bit of peacefulness, weakening of the hindrances a little bit, some respite from confusion, just managing reactivity, you know, all of that's fine, you know, often. But it's good to also remember what we're really trying to do here and what the real potential that we all have is. And we come to our cushion or our walking path and can be enthusiastic and optimistic. It's like this greed, hatred and delusion thing is like a veil. which isn't the truth. And then there's a potential right there where that greed, hatred and delusion is. There's another potential right there. And then if you have the good fortune to meet somebody like Ajahn Chah, you might meet a human being who's done it. And they do still exist in the world, beings, and there's people who've cultivated this insight to some degree, and you can see that they have a quality of radiance and well-being and spaciousness, non-grasping. And then there's people who've cultivated to a greater degree. So it's still happening. The path, the teachings of the Buddha are here. The path to cultivating insight is here. And the way to liberation is still in the world. People are practicing it. People are getting the results. And we all have that potential. So just like to encourage you all to feel optimistic, enthusiastic, and about your potential. I believe in Nirvana. The Buddha said, I believe that this is our potential. And the Buddha said, it's the foundation upon which truth rests, this potential of human beings. That's a beautiful thought. The very foundation upon which truth rests is this reality, which is beyond greed, hatred, and delusion, is beyond words, but apparently very blissful experience. Good to remember that that's why we do a lot of the practices that we do, that that will be the outcome. As long as we stay focused and we do the practice, that's where it's going. So any questions? Any more questions? Yep.
Mm-hmm. I heard earlier some talks of a Sri Lankan monk, and he was talking about, was teaching in the East and in the West, and he was saying that it happens many times, sometimes, that more and more going on with the practice. He could see that it sometimes happens that the ego, instead to become small and humble, becomes bigger and bigger and develops conceit.
Mm.
And he was saying that he could notice that this was more in the West than the East. And that impressed me, because from my small experience, I have also the same experience. So my question is to you, that you are Western but live in the East, if you see this risk, this danger, to develop conceit, and if you see it more in the West, and if it's like that, what can, because we have different conditions,
we have big selves. We have that.
This third question is, one of my Asian teachers observed that some Westerners become more conceited after practicing meditation for a long time, rather than more humble. How can I practice so that this won't happen? Any thoughts?
Right, okay, so this is a very juicy question, thank you. A juicy question, I said. Tricky. It is danger. Ajahn Chah said ditti and mana was the biggest obstruction for Westerners, so that is the conceit of views. Now, the thing which has a conceited view, of course, is the self. So that feeling of I know and I'm right, which all of us struggle with, at least all of the Westerners that I know. this is a challenge. This can also go in the opposite direction, funny enough, that I hate myself, I want to kill myself, is actually very conceited. And this is an interesting thing to contemplate. What conceit means is there's a lot of self-perception there. So actually, if somebody hates themselves, actually you need to bring a lot of compassion to that and heal and stop aiming aversion at the self. That's not helpful. So that needs to be given some skillful attention. But this area of conceit is interesting. If through one's practice one begins to feel conceited, then it's appropriate to compare oneself to beings whose development is more superior than one's own. But this is tricky, because if you're feeling depressed and you do that, that's a nightmare. It's like, if I'm going to compare myself to my teacher in Thailand on a bad day, I'd give up. So it's like, but if I start to think, I'm very special, I'm an Ajahn, I've been a monk for 10 years now, that's very special. Very few human beings can do what I've done. If I start to think that, and if I really believe it, then I have to ask myself, well, do you have metta jhana, Ajahn Achalo? No, I don't, by the way. Do you have the jhana, do you have fourth jhana, pure equanimity, Ajahn Achalo? Have you established the insight into path and fruit? Are you an unshakable sotapanna, Ajahn Achalo? And what will happen? There have been a couple of occasions. I don't think I have that much kilesa in that area, at least not lately, in terms of puffing up and thinking I'm that wonderful. But there have been some occasions, and what I've noticed is you have to prick the inflation. And it's like, what usually happens is, oh, I don't have jhana. I'm not a sotapanna. Okay, I guess I'm not that special. And something actually happens, there is a kind of a... So at times it's appropriate to compare oneself. What's my level of compassion like compared to the Dalai Lama? And how devoted am I in my selfless activities compared to the Dalai Lama? How much patience and renunciation do I have compared to Ajahn Sumedho? I don't know how well you know Ajahn Sumedho, but because I have personal chats with him, the amount of praise and blame that he has to practice with is extraordinary. And, all the people who leave Amaravati because it isn't what they wanted it to be, and all of the monks and nuns that disrobe because, the conditions weren't supportive enough. If Ajahn Sumedho believed those kind of thoughts, he wouldn't still be here. All the times that he felt, I'm a very senior monk, I've developed some insight, people should be respectful to me, and if they're not, I'm leaving. He would have left in the first year. So it's like, we do have among us people with quite remarkable qualities. So, I can bring to mind, compared to Ajahn Sumedho's commitment, where am I at my level of commitment? Compared to his patience, compared to his wisdom, compared to his consistency of mindfulness. So at those times when conceit is around, a little bit of holding a mirror to that is helpful. And then, don't let it go too far, because if you start to lose confidence in your ability or energy for your practice, that's going too far. So it's good to remember, we have the potential to develop insight. Maybe we've developed some insight already, have to keep going. Of course, real insight's going to point at not self. So Ajahn Anand, my teacher in Thailand, is a fairly small man. He's short and he's very humble. So when it's time to speak Dhamma, he can be quite fierce. And when he's not speaking Dhamma, he can hide in an empty room. There's not a feeling of a big being there. So living with people like that's very helpful. And I've seen him in public situations when he's out of his monastery and he just drops, the moment he leaves, all of the roles. And you might see him walking through an airport and it's like, you would not think that this monk was anything special at all by his body language or energetic projections. It's just emptiness and not grasping. So living with people like that is a very nice mirror if one has the possibility. Ajahn Liam, who Ajahn Chah chose as his abbot after he was going to pass away in Thailand, is an extraordinarily humble and modest man, and amazingly so. And yet he does his duty every day. Every single day he gives a reflection to his monks after the meal, every day without fail. about how to develop the insight, how to practice with monastic conventions, and he does his duty immaculately, and he has not the slightest sense of self-importance. It's a huge monastery. It's a monk that Ajahn Chah chose to pick up his role after he died. Didn't want it particularly either. That's probably why Ajahn Chah chose him. And there's the sutta where the Buddha talks about the 9 types of conceit. Are you aware of that one? It's an interesting one to contemplate, if I hope I can remember it correctly. If on occasion where you have a skill which is more developed than someone else, and you think that you're more developed than someone else, that's conceit. If you think that you're equal to that person, even though you're more developed in that area, that's conceit. If you think you're less developed than that person, even though you're more developed, that's conceit. If you're equal to a person in a certain quality and you think you're better, that's conceit. If you're equal and you think you're equal, that's conceit. If you're equal but you think you're less than that person, it's conceit. If you are less developed in a certain quality than somebody but you think you're superior, that's conceit. If you're less developed and you think you're equal, that's conceit. And if you're less developed and you think you're less developed, it's conceit. So that's an interesting thing to get an idea for what conceit is. It's the whole conceiving of self and other and all of the things we do about that. I think the kind of conceit you're talking about is that when we think that we're really good and special, that I've been doing this for a certain amount of time. So there's ways to investigate that. Just coming back to body feeling, or investigating the body, what's so special about my body? Is it excrement? Is it the fat? Is it the aging skin? There's various ways that we can apply insight practice to challenging that sense of self which thinks it's special. But in terms of the conceit that many people suffer is that not feeling good enough and not feeling worthy and having aversion aimed at the self. Dhamma practice is always being aimed at the middle way and bringing things into a balance. And so in that situation, very important to aim loving kindness at a conventional self. So you see, when there's times to apply insight and then there's times to allow there to be a conventional self and be really, really kind to it. And then once you can get that self to a kind of a healthy well-being, you can develop insight again. Just wanted to mention that as well, because a lot of people have ill will internalized. A lot of people need to do work there. So to do that, you need to be kind to the conventional self. Heal that and learn to not do that. So I hope some of that was helpful. Any questions, comments?
This final question is, how do we bridge this being aware of the inherent suffering and unsatisfactoriness of conditions with the eventual liberation from suffering? How do we work with that?
Identify with those moments of peacefulness and emptiness where there isn't much of a sense of self. Okay, that's the real me. It's like, just as an exercise, at a certain point one will have to kind of investigate that attachment and that assumption as well, but basically as a training, trying not to identify with dukkha, trying to identify with the potential of the mind. So most of us, even on bad days, if we really apply ourselves to meditating and really stick with the meditation object, after half an hour, there is more spaciousness, more clarity in the mind. So it's like, okay, this is my potential. This is pointing to my potential. The other stuff is karma and delusion. But it's right in there, isn't it? The Four Noble Truths, they're linked. Because there is greed, hatred and delusion, there is the path leading away from it. Because there is a state of not liberation, there is liberation. There's a link there. The Buddha didn't just teach dukkha. And it's why they're noble truths.
Well, it's a sense of relief. There is a sense of seeing it in that perspective. I'm trying to say from dukkha to nirvana is quite a big jump. To be in this kind of middle.
So what... This is where I think samatha plays a very important role in this process, the well-being that can come from samatha practices. And many Westerners, because of our intellects, skip over it. And also dana. So many of us are generous from a dutiful kind of place. Okay, I should be generous, the Buddha said I should. When you see Southeast Asians come to the temple with their offerings, I mean, they're really blissing out. So it's not, like, I have to be generous because of dukkha. It's like they really have faith in the value of generosity. So just as a practice, it's like it's okay to have faith that generosity and sila is going to result in nibbana and mental cultivation. And it's fine to feel really positive about that. Just as valid as completely identifying with one's negative habits. Probably more skillful. And so you can see, okay, be generous and then rejoice in being generous. That's called chaganusati, which is one of the anusatis, which is a samatha practice. Consciously be generous and then recollect I was generous and feel good and happy about it. It's not. There's still probably some dukkha there if people want to look at it. Subtle, but subtle dukkha, because there's still, you know, a self and it's conditioned. But, you know, the Buddha's recommending being generous and the Buddha's recommending recollecting one's generous acts as being skillful. So there's that. Then there's the other samatha practices, metta bhavana, there is dukkha, yeah, but you can suffuse your own mind, your own heart, your own body with loving kindness. Once you've done that, you can radiate it outwards. Once we can do that, there's much less dukkha in experience, isn't there? It's like really apply some energy to generating the heart of loving kindness, and dukkha is already much less because it's a divine abiding. A mind state like a heavenly beings. So there are things, a lot of things that we can do to make our dukkha more manageable on this path of working towards going beyond dukkha. And faith, if one does really believe the Buddha was enlightened, and since that time thousands of other beings have been enlightened, well, that's a very uplifting contemplation. And then if one believes that that's one's own ultimate potential, that's very uplifting as well. And I remember when I was a teenager kind of thinking that something was fundamentally wrong with the world, and I remember being really worried about myself. And I remember thinking something was fundamentally wrong with me. And I was really worried about myself because no one else seemed to be thinking that around me. And I'm thinking, but something's really wrong. Something not quite right about this picture. And when I heard those teachings that essentially my mind is affected by greed, hatred and delusion and that's why I suffer, I felt so relieved. I was like, oh yeah, that's what it is. And then, but then you hear that you have the potential to do something about this. I also just had it intuitively, I felt that that's true. Like I know that there's got to be more than this experience, this flawed, faltered, painful, frustrating experience. I just, there's an intuition which most of us have, we wouldn't be here otherwise, that there is something beyond this. And then to hear that teaching that the fundamental characteristic of conditioned experience is unsatisfactoriness, oh, that was such a relief. Because that's what I knew. I thought, yeah, it really is. Nothing to that point when I was 20 when I did my first retreat had been completely satisfactory. I was very, very frustrated about that. And I was completely unconvinced that anything I could see was going to lead to satisfaction. It was very, very frustrating. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Thank goodness I met these teachings that there is a path which leads to less and less suffering and then ultimately no suffering. But there is a lot of joy along the path if one knows how to practice correctly. So this is where the samatha and vipassana, the insight, balanced with uplifting, calming, brightening contemplations is, and the generosity thing, this is enormously important, very, very helpful. If we really understand that generosity is going to help us have more joyful mind states, good karma ripens as pleasant feelings. If you can take that on as a view, very, very helpful. Because, you know, whatever good thing you can do, you can know that there's going to be more and more pleasure in my life as a being in samsara until I go beyond samsara. You know, that's optimistic at least. And there's always something we can do. We can always give something. And that's going to have good fruit. That's what helps me to see that bridge between dukkha and then eventually liberation as a path, cultivating good, avoiding harm. Anyway, talking for a while. Hope that some of what I said tonight is of some benefit to some of you.